Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Jim Garrity is on spring break. Ian Tuttle of National Review is in for Jim today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And once again, we really don't have a good martini for you from a conservative perspective. Ian, I was toying around earlier, maybe the distraction of March Madness and some phenomenally dramatic games, comebacks, collapses, however you want to describe them, all over the place, major upsets in the first round. Mm-hmm. A nice distraction of something we can count on every year from the depressing news of the political world. But then, of course, when you look at the different collapse and the teams that were in perfect position to win and blew it, you start to wonder which team resembles the Republican Party right now as we head into 2016.
It's exactly right. But, you know, maybe if Texas A&M can come back from, you know, 12 down with 44 seconds left, conservatives can come back and clinch this. That's the best silver lining I can do.
Absolutely. Hey, yeah, that can get done in 44 seconds. A lot can get done in 7.5 months. So very, very good. Good optimism to start out. And bank that optimism because you're going to need it for the rest of this podcast. Ian, there seemed to be really within minutes of Justice Scalia passing back in February what the Republican approach was going to be to this vacancy on the Supreme Court. And that was simply going to be that we're in an election year. The process has begun. It's very intense. The nomination of a Supreme Court justice shouldn't take place in that sort of environment. We've got people from Chuck Schumer to Joe Biden going back years saying that that shouldn't happen in election year. So that's the Republican position. The candidates said it on the stage that night at the debate that they had. I think it was in South Carolina. And Mitch McConnell has been holding the line. Chuck Grassley has been holding the line. But little by little, you've got a few senators saying maybe we should have hearings. Maybe we should even have a vote if you're Mark Kirk of Illinois. But as far as the presidential candidates go, most of them have been pretty consistent about what the plan ought to be here. But then John Kasich decided to go and face the nation with John Dickerson.
As someone who's talked about unity, would you take a look at Mr. Garland when you if you were elected president?
Well, you know, he received, overwhelming support, I think, even from Senator Hatch. So, of course, we'd think about it.
Ian,
Good start.
John Kasich has an interesting way of not keeping the narrative on this particular issue, because now you can say, if you're a Democrat, well, look, if this guy is so good that you would even consider him as a Republican presidential candidate, surely there's no good reason not to consider him now.
Right. A couple things. One is this is so perfectly John Kasich, right? He's running as the sweetness and light candidate to counteract what he perceives as this vicious bipartisanship. And so he's put himself in a position where he's liable to make comments like this. And I think this is genuinely probably where Kasich's heart lies on the matter. All of that said, now he's in the position of having to walk it back because he's so ridiculously out of line with the Senate consensus on this. And he's given exactly what you said, Greg, Democrats a terrific point of attack here. So this is an example of how John Kasich's, what I think is a disingenuous, to be perfectly frank, tack in this campaign is not only liable to hurt him, but liable to hurt the few matters of consensus that Republicans have right now.
As you mentioned, he did try to walk it back because there was a pretty quick reaction to what he had to say about Judge Garland. So John Kasich, there's a lot of frustration involved with him right now in terms of his campaign strategy, the fact that his campaign still exists, and all sorts of other things. But another reason to kind of bang your head against the table. Okay, on to what I would probably consider the worst martini of the day, and that is the glorified visit to Havana, Cuba by President Obama. As you've probably noticed, Ian, the mainstream media is just enthralled with this. He's the first president to go since 1928, but conditions in Cuba are a tad different than they were in 1928. They had that whole, you know, communist revolution thing there back in the late 1950s. You've got the president not even being received at the airport by Raul Castro, so obviously a sign of disrespect there. There's a major photo op in front of a mural of Che Guevara. And you've got arrests galore. This is from USA Today. They were following this group called Ladies in White. They were hoping to protest without getting arrested. And USA Today reports, despite dozens of international reporters in town for Obama's trip, the group was quickly rounded up in buses and police cars. There's another guy who's supposed to meet with Obama in Cuba. He's the head of the Cuban Commission on Human Rights and National Reconciliation. His name is Elizardo Sanchez. And the New York Times reports that he spent much of his time tracking the kinds of detentions he was subjected to on Saturday. For 3 hours, he was detained. And so the government had also intensified its campaign of intimidation, making more than 1,000 arrests each month in the run-up to Mr. Obama's visit. So, Ian, the human rights record is not getting any better. The U.S. has made major concessions, of course, with the diplomatic relations, lifting of the trade. There's going to be businesses doing a whole lot more activity in Cuba. And the only thing we seem to have gotten for it is Cuba releasing Alan Gross, who never should have been in jail anyway.
Yeah. What we got from it is this trip, right? We got this series of photo ops that will now get to go into the Barack Obama Presidential Library, and people can come and ooh and aah and talk about what an amazing legacy he had and how transformative it was, because he can stand in front of these dilapidated buildings while, you know, political dissidents are beaten in the side streets away from the cameras. That's what we got out of this. It's appalling, it's reckless, it's irresponsible, and it's truly disheartening for the people who've worked for years and decades to try to transform the situation in Cuba. He's legitimized the regime now, and he's given it the imprimatur of the United States government. That's not only going to be economically beneficial, obviously, but it's politically beneficial, and it means that the one steadfast, supposedly steadfast ally that political dissidents had is no longer there. They're genuinely alone, which is something that certainly never would have happened under George Bush, and ideally would never happen under President Cruz. But as far as the other candidates go, it's hard to see them actually reversing stance on this, reversing the formal policy on this. So it's just enormously disheartening. And I think perhaps the grossest aspect is just Obama's cheerleading through all of this. He's going to wave, and he's already been tweeting. There's as someone pointed out, President Obama, no one received your tweets because they don't have internet, right? But he's going to smile and wave and attend the baseball game, and everybody's going to be glowing about this. And it's truly an example of how this president, his administration, have made perception become reality. And the perception is now going to be that Cuba is this country on the rise. And the fact is that for the vast majority of people, that's absolutely not the case.
I was listening to CBS Radio News this morning, and the reporter said that Obama's visit was erasing the final trace of the Cold War, because apparently either we're okay with them being communist and repressive now, or somehow they're not anymore because Obama visited.
So perfect. So perfect.
All right. On to the final martini now, and the AIPAC summit having its annual conference in Washington. I believe every remaining presidential candidate except for Bernie Sanders is going to address the group. Hillary went first this morning, and she took a couple of shots at Donald Trump. Ian, I condensed this down to one cut. The other one I was going to use, the volume started to ratchet up, and as we've established in the past, I'm trying to save your ears just in case she actually wins in November. And here's what she said about her commitment to Israeli security.
America can't ever be neutral when it comes to Israel's security or survival. We can't be neutral when rockets rain down on residential neighborhoods, when civilians are stabbed in the street, when suicide bombers target the innocent. Some things aren't negotiable. And anyone who doesn't understand that has no business being our president.
Ian, I'll give you a moment to compose yourself after the raw passion of what she had to say there. But for folks who looked at her time as Secretary of State, neutrality would probably have been a good thing from the Obama administration, given that Hillary laid the groundwork for the Iran deal. And, of course, she was Secretary of State while the Muslim Brotherhood rose up in Egypt and all sorts of other radical activity to help to destabilize the region.
Yeah, exactly right. First, I need to go back and and watch that. Is she blinking Morse code as she says it? I guess she's trying to be sober, but that doesn't help the robotic meme. Yeah, look, I'm all for hitting Donald Trump on this, which I thought both Senators Rubio and Cruz just absolutely demolished him in the most recent debates. On this subject, he's absolutely incoherent on it, and you know it would be a true danger for Donald Trump to be the go-to guy for Israel. You know, Obama is openly hostile. Donald Trump is just completely unpredictable. He'd be absolutely whimsical when it came to what he thinks about Israel from day to day. You know, as this isn't just another real estate deal. But that's obviously the way that he wants to approach it. But the other thing is, it's very, as you point out, Greg, it's enormously rich for Hillary Clinton to be the one saying I'm going to be the staunch ally, since her entire 4 years were spent doing as much as she could to destabilize the region, to usher in all of these theocratic populist movements, or to give the Ayatollahs and the regime in Tehran as much legitimacy as she could manage, and then followed up by John Kerry's utterly pusillanimous approach to Israel. The one good thing in all of this is that Hillary Clinton actually has a record on these issues. And for anyone who is interested in the security of Israel, anyone who is looking at who's going to be the best candidate to provide some sort of stability or sobriety when it comes to handling the absolute dumpster fire that is Middle East relations right now, you can go back to Hillary Clinton's record, take a quick glance and say, I don't think it's her.
Ian, she got a pretty rousing reception at this thing, and the applause made me wonder if people understand that record, or are we in a position where we're so worried about what Donald Trump is tweeting and whether anybody gets grabbed by the collar at a rally in one direction or the other, that we're ever even going to get into the record at this point.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. She, you know, this is what I anticipate we're going to see if Donald Trump is the nominee. All she has to do is position herself as a contrast to his recklessness, his bull in a china shop mentality, and say, you know, I've held elected office, I've been Secretary of State, I'm going to be stable and even keel, and you know what you're going to get with me. And she can ride that faux statesmanship right to Pennsylvania Avenue.
On that exhilarating note, Ian, back to banging the head against the desk. Talk to you tomorrow.
Indeed. Sorry it's always so so grim with me, Greg.
Ian Tuttle of National Review, in for Jim Garrity. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.